from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our second hour this morning, stories about nuclear threats and political deadlocks between America and North Korea, Iran and Cuba often fill the headlines, but what's it like to be a tourist or a backpacker traveling through those countries? Tony Wheeler, co-founder of the Lonely Planet Guidebooks, offers his tips for traveling safely and smartly through conflicted areas and tells his own stories of misadventures in what he calls the Darklands. He'll join us in studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. The New York Times called Tony Wheeler, the 1973 co-founder of the Lonely Planet budget travel guidebooks, the trailblazing patron saint of the world's backpackers and adventure travelers. The guidebooks have sold upwards of 100 million copies, and in 2011, Tony Wheeler and his wife Maureen sold the company. But he continues to travel and to write about his travels, as he did in Badlands, a book inspired by the characterization by former President George Bush of North Korea, Iran, and Iraq as the axis of evil. And now he's published a book called Darklands, a book which is based on his travels into countries like Congo, Haiti, Pakistan, Colombia, and Palestine and Israel. Tony Wheeler joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you.
I should mention Tony Wheeler has traveled probably in between 160, 170 countries, has blazed trails for many of you who have used the Lonely Planet guidebooks, but he got lost in San Jose just the other day.
I don't know the way to San Jose at all, and I took the wrong freeway exit, and before you know it, I was going around in circles, and the only thing that guided me home was I could see the planes coming into the airport, so I knew I had to go off that direction.
San Jose is easy compared to the East Bay. The South Bay actually is not as labyrinthine, at least as I find the East Bay, but that's almost heartening to know that you, of all people, would get lost here in the Bay Area, although... You know, I was for the first time, I always wondered about where Lonely Planet came from, and then I discovered it comes from a Joe Cocker song, but it comes from a mistake. Right?
It does. You know, the whole thing has been an error from the very beginning. The line in the song talked about a lovely planet, not a lonely planet. And I said to Maureen, my wife, that sounds good. Why don't we call the business Lonely Planet? And she said, great idea, except it's the wrong name.
Except it does have a kind of branding that has been very successful for you. A lot of people would, what do I want to know about a lonely planet? I don't want to know about loneliness, right?
And, you know, I really like the way it has sort of become part of the vocabulary. I've seen several scientific articles where, you know, the astronomers discover a new planet and they call it a lonely planet. It's out there and you can see what they're thinking about when they say that.
It's kind of hard to keep up sometimes with what's in vogue as far as travel. I know China is in and obviously Syria is out, but Afghanistan. There was an article in the New York Times about a budding tourist industry in Afghanistan, particularly in Bamiyan, where there's a lot of skiing in old Buddha places. And
no, look, I wish the Buddhas were still there. And
I mean the places for the Buddhas.
Yeah, exactly. And Afghanistan, if ever they sorted the problems out, would have a huge tourist business because it's a fascinating country with great history, so much to see. It's just packed with really, really interesting things to see. And unfortunately, of course, it's got hardly any tourists at all. But you do meet a few enterprising tourists. And I was back there about 6 years ago. And I actually, there was the same hotel that I'd stayed in the early 70s. And it had survived everything. And it was the son of the owner in the 70s, had reopened it. And I think that's just wonderful when that sort of thing happens.
Well, you're promoting the Solomon Islands in this new book. I mean, you think it deserves more visitors, you've said. Did you get into a swimming thing like the JFK did?
The JFK Island. There's a little resort called Fat Boys, which you can stay at, and you can look across the strait, and there, right over there, is they call it JFK or Kennedy Island now. I don't think the original name clearly wasn't Kennedy Island. And I just took a kayak out from the resort one morning and paddled out across the passage and landed on the beach. And I thought, this is wonderful. I'm doing something which, you know, very few people get an opportunity to do, to walk ashore on that beach just like Kennedy did how many years earlier? 70 years earlier?
Well, I was thinking about your two books in tandem. I mean, The Badlands, as I suggested, was started or inspired by George W. Bush talking about the axis of evil, I know. And you talk about places like Afghanistan in that book, as well as Burma or Myanmar, which is becoming more of a kind of tourist magnet. Cuba, more people going to Cuba. Not so sure people want to go to Saudi Arabia or Libya, or for that matter, go to Albania. But the new book, Darklands, takes us to places that I think most people would never consider going to. I mean, let's start with Congo, you know. Vachel Lindsay notwithstanding, you know, bingo, bongo, bongo, I don't want to leave the Congo. This is not a place that's on most people's travel list.
No, it isn't. Well, it's been on mine for a long, long time. I'd always wanted to go to the Congo. And I think part of that is just it's inspired writers. You know, right back to Conrad, Heart of Darkness, yes. Poisonwood Bible, Barbara Kingsolver. You know, Bend in the River, V.S. Naipaul, it's inspired fantastic
writing. And our
writing.
Own Adam Hochschild, who wrote about the history. And you write a lot about the history
in this
book. Yeah,
that's right. His history book is fantastic. And it's really readable as apart from everything else. So it's a country which, you know, is really interesting. And I won't say I had an absolutely straightforward time there, because it's not a straightforward country to visit. But I did have a really interesting time.
Well, you were arrested there.
I got arrested. And you know, it's one of those things, if you go to Ireland and you don't get a little bit drunk some night, you really haven't, you know, paid enough attention to Guinness or Irish whiskey. And if you don't go to the Congo and don't get arrested, well, you really haven't been to the Congo.
Well, I may have to correct you on something. This is the pedant in me, but you say when you write about Congo that and there's all this good history going back to Lumumba and Mobutu and all that, but you say at one point that the city that used to be Leopoldville, which is now Kinshasa, is the largest speaking French-speaking city in the world, but Wikipedia says, no, Montreal is third, you know, Kinshasa is second, and Paris is still on top. I don't know how you measure those.
It probably depends how good you count their French. You know, and the French will probably go there and say, nobody speaks French here.
We just like they do it in Quebec, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what I understand what drew you to the Congo, I mean, just because not only literary, but it's such a different world, Heart of Darkness and all that. Would you recommend it, though, as a place?
Look, there's a lot of places that I would say, great, you'll have an amazing, interesting time, but don't even think of going there unless you know what you're doing. I love scuba diving, but it always seems to me that learning scuba diving, first of all, is learning the thousand ways you can kill yourself underwater. And you, every time you go in the water, you need to think about that. You need to think, I'm doing something which isn't all that safe. I'm going underwater with this tank on my back, and it's a long way up to the surface. And you should be responsible for that. You shouldn't say somebody else should be looking after me. And it's the same thing with going to places like the Congo or Afghanistan. You shouldn't go there unless you're aware that these are not the safest places in the world.
Well, they're, as you say, they're troubled places. They're failed states. In fact, I think somebody once asked you what the weirdest place you ever were visiting. Didn't you say North Korea? Because it's a
Absolutely.
Whole Potemkin country. Yeah.
It's a Potemkin country. We've got Potemkin villages, and they've built a Potemkin country. And it's why I don't, you know, all this sort of nuclear threat from North Korea, they can barely trip over their own feet, let alone, you know, the idea of them launching a missile, a serious missile anywhere, I just can't see.
Actually, somebody just put a video out. It went viral. It's one of these speeded up videos, you know, that looks like it's on steroids. And it's of Pyongyang. And actually, subways look like they're running. Of course, they had them only videotape in certain places, to be sure. But it looks like a busy, thriving metropolis.
Yeah, it's an attractive city. And, you know, the subway is really very impressive. It's a bit like a cross between the best stations in Moscow, which has a wonderful subway system, and the, you know, the really artistic ones in Paris. It's got a bit of both of those things. And yet you stay in a hotel there and you look out at night and there's not a car moving on the street and there's hardly any lights lit because they haven't got enough electricity to do that and no cars. You know, the way for the South Koreans to take over North Korea, because they're not sure they want to, knowing what an expense it would be, seems to me it would be to parachute in telephones and Hyundai cars.
We're talking to Tony Wheeler, and his new book is called Darklands, and he'll be in San Jose if you can find your way there tonight at 7 p.m. at the Hoover Theater, it's sponsored by the Commonwealth Club, but it's an event co-sponsored with the Commonwealth Club. Now, you write about Pakistan, and you write about Haiti, and I want to talk about those, and even a place that probably very few listeners are familiar with Nauru, which is, I'll never get out of my mind, bird poo because of reading your chapter on that. But let's talk, for example, about Colombia first, because this would not be, I mean, you got mugged there. and you think about drug cartels, and you think, and I know a lot of Colombians, they don't like those associations. But the fact of the matter is, there were Australian tourists in Yaranasi by native who were held captive. And so it's got a bad rap in many ways. You almost make it sound like a place that really should be visited.
I think so. I think it's a place that's really come back in recent years. And the Australians and others who were kidnapped in this one particular little tale I tell, that's 10, 15 years ago. It's not recent history. And it's a wonderful country to visit. The best colonial architecture anywhere in South America. It's got a Caribbean coast and a Pacific coast. It's got snow-capped mountains. You can see from the Caribbean another Machu Picchu called Ciudad Perdida, the Lost City. It's got all sorts of terrific attractions.
Yeah, I didn't know until I read you. Bogota is two times the altitude of Kathmandu.
Bogota is high up. And my first trip there, I flew in there to start with and sort of went running around town. And I'm thinking, why am I so breathless? Am I getting unfit in my old age? And then you realize just how high it is.
And Haiti is certainly not a place that most people think of as a place to visit. And yet people I know who go there, and many people go there to help after the earthquake and so forth, or help with the poverty, which is wretched. But people who go there love the people, love the culture.
It's a heroic country. There's a country that rose up and overthrew the slave masters, which were the French at that time.
Toussaint L'Ouverture.
Toussaint, what a great name. Yeah. I mean, if you want to have George Washington sounds pretty good, but Toussaint L'Ouverture, that's a fantastic name. It was absolutely heroic what the Haitians did, and yet they've had this just dramatically bad history, one thing going wrong after another. And of course, the great names, even the bad guys there, Papa Doc. What a name to have for an evil dictator.
And you mentioned literary influences. I mean, the comedians, not only Graham Greene's novel, but the movie that was made of that makes it seem like really a sinister place in many people's minds. But it is this poor basket case of the Caribbean, and yet, you know, alive with all of this life and vitality.
Yeah, the great music, and the buses are so beautifully painted. They're wonderful. The best naive art anywhere in the Pacific, in the Caribbean. You know, it's a really interesting destination.
I think of Cuba that way, too. I mean, I visited Cuba, and I found, you know, the poverty was pretty wretched, but a lot of life and vitality, music and art.
Yeah, absolutely. I've only been to Cuba twice, but I had quite a few years in between, and I was there earlier this year. And I think it's changing, but of course it's really going to change when the Castros go and when relations with the United States sort out.
Some say it'll be like Disneyland.
Well, it could be, and I think other countries in the Caribbean are really worried what's going to happen when Cuba does open up, because anybody who's thinking I'll go here or I'll go there, it's just going to be Cuba, first of all, and everything else is going to be second best.
Well, you do tell some great stories in this new book of yours. I like that story in Haiti where a guy walks up to you, strolls up to you and says, I'd like some of your money, and then walks away.
Yeah.
How often does that sort of thing happen?
Just, you know, politely asking, you've got some, I'd like some.
You also point out, like I say, you get to know a lot of the history, and you point out that Cuba was, that Haiti was, of course, part of Hispaniola, and the other part became the Dominican Republic, and you have the split between the Spanish and the Creole. You also have much more per capita income in the Dominican Republic and much better circumstances. But it's almost like capitalism, communism with Haiti and Cuba, as you point out.
Yeah, it does go both ways. And one of the things that I made two visits to Haiti writing this book, and one of them I decided what I really needed to do was to go into the Dominican Republic first and then come across to Haiti by bus. So I'd see both countries and I'd cross the border. And you know, one of the things you see is deforestation on the Haitian side because they're so desperate for anything for fuel that if you can burn it, you chop it down. Whereas, you know, there are forests on the Dominican Republic side. But on the other hand, you know, here's a good capitalist country, Haiti, and it's much worse off than a bad communist country, Cuba. And you can almost see one from the other.
Since we're talking about those divides between communism and capitalism, there's also the great divide between Palestine and Israel, and you went both places. Were you fearful?
No, I wasn't fearful at all in the
neither place.
No, not in either place. I've said numerous times that the weirdest country I've ever been to is North Korea, no question. And the second weirdest has to be Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's a very strange country. And then third, I'd put Israel and Palestine, because I don't even know what it is. Is it a country, or is it two countries, or is it one country occupying another country, or is it, what is it? I don't know.
Well, you get into the history and you get into the politics. You also get into, the difficult bureaucratic things that you had to face in both of these places. You got stoned, and I don't mean in the sense of marijuana.
Like, that's almost the Palestine-Israel thing. If you don't get arrested in the Congo and if you don't get stoned in Palestine, you really haven't been there.
What did this do for your sympathies, I mean, one way or the other?
I found it very difficult. One of the things I did when I was there, I'm a great believer in walking. You know, you only really see a place when you walk around it. And any new city I go to, the first thing I do is dump my bag at the hotel and set out and walk around and learn where things are. So I spent several days walking in Israel and Palestine. With an Israeli friend, I walked down the Israel National Trail through the Negev Desert for about four days. I spent a day walking on a thing called the Jesus Trail up in Galilee, again with some Israeli friends.
And you go to Rebecca's tomb as well.
Yeah, which is, there's a controversial site. But I also spent a day walking in the West Bank with a guide from one of the refugee camps. You know, and I heard his complaints, and some of them are very logical and some of them are not.
So you come away sort of with equanimity and
I come away with no
neutrality.
I hope neutrality, but it's one of those situations that the more time you spend looking at it, the less you understand it.
I think you use the word phrase "tar baby," which I once got in trouble for. By the way, some people find that racist. Believe it or not,
it's an old fairy tale, isn't it?
It's Uncle Remus. Yeah,
it is Uncle Remus. You know, the two of them are stuck together, and the more the more the Israelis try and get away from it. At the same time, the more settlements they build, and then the settlements are just sticking them together. And they're saying we want to put a wall up and keep you away, but then we're going to build five more settlements and tie you to us. I just can't understand it.
You make a very good point about the settlements. You say there are those who are there for economic reasons and those who are there for ideological reasons, and I think that's pretty much the split.
There is a split, yeah.
You also talk about pickpockets and overcharging taxi drivers, dishonest taxi drivers. I mean, a lot of that more so?
It's a little bit. I only had one vague attempt at pickpocketing while I was in the region. You go anywhere where people are not well off and someone's going to try and pickpocket you someplace.
So at Rebecca's tomb, they offered you a yarmulke, a kippah, and you refused?
Yeah, I did refuse. I felt, if I was... Because, it's one of those disputed sites where two sides claim it. And, I don't want to take sides. I don't want to... If I'm going there pretending I'm Jewish, which I'm not, I'm taking a side in a way, and I didn't want to do that.
And when you went to Pakistan, fear there?
Yeah, I was a little bit trepidatious at times. And I've got a long history with Pakistan because I lived there for a few years when I was a very small child, sort of kindergarten age. My father was working there.
Plus, you did the whole hippie trail. Industry that you started.
Absolutely. I crossed the Khyber Pass from Afghanistan and came down across Pakistan in the 70s when it was a much more peaceful place than it is today. But I've been back as well. I've been back with an aid group after the big earthquake there a few years ago. So I've been back quite a few times over the years. And again, I had a wonderful time when I was there. And it was a really critical time to be there because it was just when that... I don't know how you define it. There they said the blasphemous American movie where somebody made some film about the prophet.
And it was used as an excuse for Benghazi and the death of an American diplomat.
Used for all sorts of things. And that was going on right when I was there in Pakistan. And it was really amusing. We were traveling up the Karakoram Highway, a spectacular road, one of the great, great roads. It's up there with Highway 1 down to L.A. It's just a fantastic road trip. Highway 1 sticks to the coast. This goes up over the mountains and drops down into China. And it was a great trip, and all this trouble was going on. And any time we looked on a TV, there it was, the riots and the signs being held up, death to America and behead Obama. We saw one of those signs. And, death to foreigners in general. And then we'd walk into some little hotel, and everybody's crowded around the television watching this. And they'd swing around and see us and say, "Oh, foreigners, come in. Would you like tea?" so the reality is different.
At the Chinese border, there's a lot of adverse feelings about the Chinese. I mean, You point out that some remarks about the Chinese believe only their only religion is money, that sort of thing, from a Pakistani point of view.
Yeah, well, the Chinese are in there in a big way. They're building the roads, and you know, it's looked upon by the Chinese. This is another potential route to the sea for them. They could come down through Pakistan to the Persian, not to the Persian Gulf, to the Arabian Sea. It's the Indian Ocean there, isn't it?
I forget
where I am. It bends round to the Persian Gulf.
Anybody should know their geography here, Tony.
Yeah, I can see the map floating in front of me.
Well, what drew you to Abbottabad? Why did you want to go? Did you speak about Osama bin Laden?
Well, that's where bin Laden, you know, met his finale. And, you know, we drove through the town, and it's an old British colonial town once upon a time, and the Methodist Church is still there, you know.
Wow.
Bin Laden could have dropped into church that morning before it all ended. And we stopped for lunch there, and I thought, well, this is a good place. They offer takeaways as well. He could have been phoning up and send me around a chicken curry for dinner. I'm expecting visitors tonight.
So of all these dark lands, maybe Pakistan in some ways is more hospitable as far as the people?
It was very hospitable, and it's a country that, you know, most of the things you find in India, you'll also find in Pakistan. It's got the mountains, it's got the Mughal history, it's got a lot of things worth seeing, but it's got no visitors.
Well, would you recommend it again?
If it was safe, I'd recommend it. And we met cyclists cycling up and down the Karakoram Highway. Not many of them, but we did meet a few travelers. I met a German guy who I crossed the border from India into Pakistan. And as I was queuing up to cross the border, there were only two of us crossing that morning. And the other one was a German guy. And I said, you know, what are you doing going to Pakistan? He said, no, I've been there for 3 months and my visa expired. And I've just hopped over to India for 24 hours to start a new visa. I'm really enjoying it, he said.
You met a German woman in Colombia. You talk about, and there's a whole thing about helicopter costs.
I didn't meet her, but that same story we started with about the people being kidnapped.
Oh, that's right. It was the Australian kidnap thing.
And she was eventually rescued, and she and a Spanish guy were the last two sort of to be rescued, and the Spanish government were quite happy to rescue their Spanish citizen, but the Germans presented her with a bill for the helicopter, and she took it to court and she lost. They enforced it.
We're talking again, if you just joined us, with Tony Wheeler. His newest book is Dark Lands, and he is co-founder with his wife of the famous Lonely Planet tour guide books. And let me open the phone lines. I know there's some of you who would just like to talk about travel, maybe like some travel advice. This is a man who's been just about virtually everywhere. We didn't even mention some of the other dark lands that come, like Papua New Guinea and
Nauru.
and Nauru, which I mentioned, which is a republic in Micronesia. But you may want to join us here with, especially like, I think it'd be interesting to hear from some of you who have traveled in scary places or dark lands or places that are weird and may want to relate some of the experiences or what particularly struck you through those travels. And if you've used the Lonely Travel books, you might want to comment on just how useful they've been, because they do have a distinct niche in terms of providing for travelers and adventurers, backpackers, budget travelers, all that sort of thing. Yeah, sound like I'm doing a PR pitch.
You're
away from this for 2 years. What do you have, anything to do with it anymore?
I still get called in, and I get called in most often for the translations of the books, particularly in China. I was in China twice last year because there are Lonely Planet guides out in Chinese, and the Chinese are just fanatical travelers. The thing they really, they want to have a new car and a big TV and the latest tablet and smartphone and so on, but really they want to travel.
To see the USA too, and all the rest of the world. Let me give out the phone number again. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us again, toll free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments about travel or anything we're talking about onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Tony Wheeler of Lonely Planet fame, and he's giving advice for traveling in, shall we say, conflicted regions, co-founder of the Lonely Planet guidebooks and author of a new book called Tony Wheeler's Dark Lands. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Hoover Theater in San Jose with the Commonwealth Club, if he can find his way there. And let's go to we'll find our way to your calls, and we'll begin with Christopher. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Christopher. You're on.
Hey, I just wanted to ask the guests about, I took a trip earlier this year to Yemen, and we were in the capital, Sana'a, which is a beautiful, beautiful city. It has an old bazaar there in the center. But then we traveled outside the city to go to visit some of these stone architecture villages up in the north. And I noticed everywhere there were these slogans painted on the walls. And after a while, I asked our guide what that meant, and he just sort of dismissed it, and he said, oh, it's, you know, it's some crazy people, some extremists. And I found out later that what it said was, you know, death to Israel, death to America. And I've heard that there's a lot of that in the region, particularly with the Shia. And I guess I wanted to ask the guest if he thought that these places were really dangerous, because our guide said, as long as you don't openly proclaim that you're American or, you know, sort of flaunt your Westernness, you're relatively safe. And everyone there seemed very welcoming, and they were happy to show us around and show us all these beautiful places, all these amazing. We went to the Rock Palace there north of Sana'a. And,
I'm struck, though, that you mentioned the Shia here, because Yemen gets a lot of press because of Al-Qaeda and the Yemen nation, and it's not ISIS, but it is Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda is Sunni, just like ISIS is Sunni. But have you been to Yemen, Tony?
Do you know, I'm seriously embarrassed to say, it's the place absolutely top of my list that I haven't been to. And it's the only country in the whole Middle East region that I haven't been to. And it is one of the most interesting. It's got this, it's not stone, it's mud, these amazing mud skyscrapers.
And Christopher, you were impressed, it sounds like, yeah?
It was some of the most amazing buildings I'd ever seen. I mean, buildings that have been standing for thousands of years, and there are the mud ones, but there are also are ones that are made literally just of rocks. And there's an incredible history there. We were fortunate enough to have a guide who was a professor, and he related to us the entire history of the Jews, the Christians, the Muslims, going back thousands and thousands of years. It was incredible, and the people were very, very friendly. A lot of them said that you're the first tourists we've seen in two or three years, which I thought was pretty neat. You know, we went into some tourist shops where everything was covered with dust.
And did you say you were an American, or did you have to say you were Canadian?
I said that I was from Argentina. The guide, our guide told us, he said, pick a country that has a really good football team and tell everyone that that's where you're from. Actually wound up having a very long conversation in Spanish with one of the natives of Tula, who spoke perfect Spanish. It was bizarre. But
it's lucky your Spanish is good, because
yes.
Although you know, I don't know if either of you found this, if you've traveled to Argentina, and you know, my Spanish is pretty decent, but it's very different idiomatically because of the European influences in Argentina.
Yeah, and of course you have to also know some football players. I mean, it's one thing to say you're from Argentina. If you couldn't come up with the team, you're in trouble. I think
everybody knows Messi, so, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, my favorite.
I think the Yemen, it's like the other places I mentioned, you know, it's not the safest destination, and you need to go there with some caution. But the other thing is, very often these things, you know, we're really against your country and we hate America or any place else, doesn't mean they hate you individually. You know, you're something different from the country. The country and the politics is one thing, and the individual is another thing. Most of the time, but things can go wrong anywhere.
Yeah, and thank you, Christopher. A lot of caution, I would say, if you're going to go to Yemen. But let me go to another caller, and that's Sarah from Benicia. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I had a comment and then a question. My comment was that about 6 years ago, during the first Thailand riots, my husband went with us to Bangkok, and the people were absolutely lovely. It wasn't, you know, we were very concerned, particularly because I was 12 weeks pregnant at the time, but everything turned out just fine. You know, I think that a lot depends on the people in that particular country. And then my question was, I was supposed to go to Thailand again, and I got switched to Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, for a conference. And being a feisty American lady, I'm a little worried about going to not just a Muslim country, but a country which is you know, number one for kidnappings, and, you know, lots of other stuff goes on.
How about Malaysian Airlines? I think people are concerned with that.
Yeah, I know. And we just we were thinking, well, maybe we should switch the leg of our trip that has to go on Malaysian Airlines, but hopefully lightning won't strike three times. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the question. Tony Wheeler.
I didn't know Malaysia was noted for kidnappings, I must admit.
Noted for problems with anybody who should be a drug user. You know,
you well, yeah, you don't want to take any drugs there.
Even a marijuana, you'd be in jail for your life.
Yeah, or, you know, heroin, and you'll be hung. I've been in Bangkok in the last 3 weeks, and it didn't...
Well, their problems are internal. There's not a lot of enmity against the U.S.
No, not at all.
But in fact, that brings up another interesting point. People go to Vietnam where they should have enmity against the United States, one could argue. And they don't. No, it's really miraculous. They hate us in Yemen, but they welcome us and like us in places like Vietnam.
Yeah.
All right, more of your calls. Let's go to Fairfield. Jim, good morning. You're on.
Thank you very much. I was very interested in what you said about Haiti since I went to Haiti for the first time this year. And right before I left, the State Department issued a warning for Americans, very dangerous, kidnapping, violence, and infectious disease. And anyway, there was never a time that I felt unsafe there, except maybe in the traffic in Port-au-Prince, which is either thrilling or terrifying, depending on how you view that. But while I was there, the government was making a major issue or a major push for increasing tourism. And I remember that Haiti was the gem of the Caribbean and a major tourist spot in the 50s. So I was wondering what Tony thought about what are the barriers for them to increase their tourism? They have to get at least the perception of personal security risk off the table, and then probably safer drinking water and safer food safety. People won't go there if they think they're going to get sick. So what are the barriers for them? And it probably applies to most any developing country.
Yeah, I think all of the above, all the things you mentioned. You know, first of all, the perception. When people think, oh, this is not safe, I shouldn't be going there, you've got a big problem immediately. There are infrastructure problems. The roads are bad. On two occasions I've been there, I've gone up to the right up to the north of the country to see this amazing thing, the Citadel. And both times I took a flight, which you'd never do in looking at the distance on the map. But the roads are so bad that if you're going to drive, it's going to take you forever to get there. Well, that's an infrastructure problem that they really have to sort out. But, you know, perception is a lot of it.
Apparently they're working on that. Apparently they're putting in a road to the Citadel.
Yeah, well, the Citadel, you know, this amazing fortress, it's the most impressive structure in the whole Caribbean. And yet, how many visitors do they get? Hardly any at all. One of the famous tourist visitors to Haiti, of course, back in the days when it was working, were the Clintons, who had their honeymoon there.
Good to hear from you, Jim. Thank you for the call. We'll go right away to another caller. Nathaniel, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Long-time listener. I was just telling the call trainer, I just got back from a seven-month-long trip riding motorcycles from San Francisco all the way down to the tip of Argentina. And so we rode through several of these countries that the speaker might have called these badlands. One of the stories was that we were in the capital of Honduras, which is considered, you know, one of the most dangerous cities in the world that's not in a war zone. And we were being driven through a market in a taxi, and there was a lot of traffic, and the driver ended up telling us that it was because somebody had been shot up ahead, and we ended up driving by and seeing that they had just put a cardboard, you know, box over him, but he was in fact dead. And so the very next day we're leaving town on our motorcycles, and we got stuck in the market exactly where this guy had been shot. And so we're sitting there and trying to get through. And all of a sudden somebody from a speaker system is announcing, hey, because they use it to advertise their products. He says, hey, you motorcyclist, like, where are you from? You know, and we're like, oh, we're traveling through from America. And he's like, oh, you're from America. Oh, okay. And so he's announcing in this market where somebody's been shot just the day before that we're travelers and that we're Americans. But what I wanted to bring up, though, is that we went through all these countries. We were in Colombia. We were in Bogota. And people are just so generous and so giving. And the Colombians especially wanted to make us aware that, like, you know, we're trying to get rid of this reputation. We know that you guys think that we're dangerous and we're just drug lords, but we're not. And the people were just so giving and generous throughout our entire trip. So...
Oh, thank you for that.
I just wanted to echo those comments.
Yeah, and thank you for the call. In fact, as you point out in your book, Tony, especially Medellin is considered, you know, like cartels and drug lords. Of course,
Was, yeah.
Mexico is becoming more that way, I suppose, in some respects. But Honduras, you know, some of these young kids who are fleeing, they're fleeing because the murders are so high and the crime rate and the gangs are so rampant.
Yeah, and you know, so much of this stuff is tied up with drugs, and it's a worldwide problem that worldwide has to be sorted out at some point. And I think it's not by continuing the war on drugs, it's deciding it's over and it's time to make peace.
We'll go to another caller, and that's Peter. Peter, you're on.
Hi, Michael. I'm relating to your invitation to share a story. In 1978, I had a chance to go to Iran.
Ooh, what a year to go. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And there was about 150 guys that were deployed by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi from his headquarters in Switzerland. And the idea was to go over there and first of all, to do meditation, kind of cool down the mental temperature and emotional temperature of the country, as a kind of air conditioning psychically and mentally. Secondly, we were to teach people. And third, if we ever got to that point, we would teach teachers. But I was one of a group of just 10 that split off and went to Abadan, Iran, where they had the world's largest oil refinery at that time. And later it was bombed out in the Iran-Iraq War. But I found the people to be extremely friendly, spiritual, and receptive. There were a lot of Britishers there that were part of the oil scene at that time. And I also, when I was in Tehran, I got a chance to make a connection with the public relations director of the NIOC, the National Iranian Oil Company. And when I was in Abadan, I actually taught meditation to the manager of the radio station.
But was this while the embassy was being held by Iranians? Is this all going on while the embassy was actually the
American
embassy?
That would have been before, I think, wouldn't it?
No, I don't think it was that exact.
I think that was 78. That's
But there was a lot of unrest and a lot of demonstrations going on.
Yeah.
But on the way out, flying back from Iran, from Abadan to Tehran, I sat next to a very friendly gentleman, and he turned out to be the owner of an aluminum factory. So he had some power in the country. And I said, and he became very friendly with me, and he learned that I would just love to have an opportunity to meet the Shah. And, you know, I was just incredulous that he might have the ability to make this connection. And I said, did he really think we could get an appointment to meet the Shah? And he said, of course. So I was just, like, enthralled. And when I got back to Tehran, I reported this. And unfortunately, the whole group was about to leave, and the Maharishi and his people knew a whole lot more about the political situation than I did, so I was not allowed to stay.
So you never met the Pahlavi throne man.
And it was such a feeling of, like, possibility that just didn't quite happen. But looking back, I guess it was the wise thing to do.
Well,
I just thought with the Shah and all his power, if I could teach him meditation, the next day the whole army would have learned. You know?
and then after, you could have taught Khomeini after that. Well, a good story, Peter. Thank you for it. Actually, here's an important question in an email, and we've done programs about women traveling by themselves. And this listener, Shelley, writes, what steps do you take to document for your women travelers the perils that their male counterparts are not exposed to and how to handle them? I was traveling in Istanbul, Turkey in 1991 and was accosted by a group of several young men. And this is happening more and more in India to women, by the way, as I'm sure you're aware. She says, although I was traveling with a male traveling companion, he went his way to go to the men's baths, and I was walking to the women's baths when I was accosted. I would imagine things are worse now. What to do?
No, I don't think so. Probably in Turkey, things would be better because Turkey has progressed so much in
it's
the last...
It's under the despot Erdogan.
Well, it's got some problems in that respect. But in other ways, Turkey is a... It's always been a country straddling Europe and Asia. But every time I go to Turkey, and I've been twice this year, it strikes me these days as much more a European country than an Asian country. It's shifted in the European direction. You know, there's no question that women do have different concerns and different problems, and they're most respects more serious than what men have to face when they're in difficult situations. But on the other hand, women have advantages as well. That in the Middle East, women who often have foreign women have a sort of honorary male status, but they're women as well. A man's only ever a man. He can talk to other men. He can never talk to the women if he's in Saudi Arabia or strictly Muslim countries like that. Women have a foot in both camps.
Now, here's something hopeful that just occurred to me. Women used to go traveling in Italy, and they would say that men would pinch their buttocks. Mm-hmm. It would be a natural thing for men to do, and it was part of their, I guess, expression of favoring female flesh or whatever. They don't do that anymore.
No, disappointing, isn't it?
Well, I didn't say it was disappointing. Heaven forfend. I'm just saying.
I'm joking.
It's a quantum change, though.
It is a change, and I think all sorts of things have changed. It's a different world in many respects.
Here's a listener, Joni, who writes, I hitchhiked through the Sudan in 1973. It was a war zone, but I met with incredible kindness and was helped at every turn. I can hardly reconcile my experience with the history and current situation of the Sudan. Has your guest been there?
You know, I haven't been to the Sudan, but a couple of years ago, there's an annual bicycle ride that goes all the way from Cairo to Cape Town. It takes 4 months. And I joined in with it further south in the Tanzania and Malawi for 2 weeks. I rode my bicycle for 2 weeks, and a lot of the other riders on this thing had come down right the way through the Sudan. And Sudan was their favorite country, almost without exception. Sudan was where they said they were most surprised
people
by the hospital.
Lovely. I mean, I've known Sudanese people, and they're just gracious and very warm people.
So who knows?
Another listener emails, curious to know if having resources, presumably the sale of Lonely Planet, was profitable, has changed how Tony travels. Is there now a temptation to throw money at a problem and go five stars, or does your guest stick to the no-frills travel from when he was less well off?
Well, I've often said that I've experienced all the bedbugs I ever need to experience in this life, and you know, enough third-class trains in third-class countries that, it you know, if I can be at the sharper end of the plane, I generally will be. But there's lots of places you go to, and if you want to go there, you're going to be a backpacker, or you're going to be in the $2 a night hotel, because the $2 a night hotel is the best place in town. One of the things I've been doing quite a lot recently, though, is I've been going to archaeological sites, because there's a Bay Area Archaeology Association called Global Heritage Fund. And they manage to sort of push me to weird and wonderful places, because archaeology is great, but you need to have visitors to it as well.
Where are you living now?
I live part of the year in London and part of the year in Melbourne in Australia. So here in San Francisco, I'm between the two homes. I'm 12 hours flight from one and 12 hours flight from the other.
Here's Chris, who writes, just wanted to mention that I did a year-long overland trip through Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and other Central Asian republics, by far the hardest traveling I have ever done. Thrown in jail a total of 6 times, and while I'm a diehard Tony Wheeler fan and an avid independent traveler, if I ever go back to Central Asia, it's on a package tour.
That's fair enough, isn't it?
Here's Peter, who writes, a few years ago I read an article in a Canadian news magazine about Pakistan's North Waziristan area, where the reporter began by talking about how remote it is and how hard it is to get in. The sentence that stood out to me was, quote, this is not a Lonely Planet destination. How does your guest feel about the phrase Lonely Planet destination coming to mean a place for mainstream tourists?
Oh, dear. There's a problem as well. You know, Lonely Planet is there's this backpacker image to Lonely Planet, which is going to be there forever. But Lonely Planet covers the comfortable destinations as well. And you can find the five-star hotels as well as the backpacker hostels.
Well, here's Andrew, who says, I love the Lonely Planet guides. I never travel without them. And I love the suggestion that, above all, one should walk around a place to get to know it. I walked across Spain and part of France for 550 miles for the Camino de Santiago in 2009, every inch of it on foot. And to prepare, I spent a month walking around Berlin and a month walking around Paris for 10 miles a day. I saw so many interesting things I'd never otherwise have seen. In Berlin, I wandered into a cemetery which still had pockmarks from a World War II rocket attack. The caretaker was 2 or 3 years old when the war ended and had grown up in East Berlin instead of West Berlin, just as an accident, because his mother had gone 3 blocks this way and instead of 3 blocks that way at the war's end. You don't get these experiences being herded around on a tour bus.
Yeah.
Another listener writes, regardless of geographic, cultural, or historic attractions, what motivates one to travel to unstable political, religious areas of the world when so many other destinations are available? Tourists gunned down in Egypt, pirates attacking boats, subjecting yourself to kidnapping, and worse in Mexico City or Pakistan or parts of Africa is not on my agenda.
But, you know, that's absolutely true. But then we've heard 15 minutes ago about, you know, gunfire in Honduras and people being... I've just read 2 stories about gunfire and people being run down by cars in Union Square. So, you know, you don't have to go to the other side of the world to find danger sometimes.
We'll go to another caller. Dave joins us. Dave, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. And big fan of Lonely Planet. My wife and I, when we started traveling about 10 years ago, that's our number one go-to source. So thank you for that. You talked a little bit about Turkey. We just got back from a month in Turkey, and I was interested in your thoughts about how travel perceptions are changing about Turkey, because virtually everybody we talked to before we went or after we got back and said we'd been there, they basically were in one of 2 camps. They either had been there before and were delighted that we had gone or were going, or they said the exact same words. is that safe? And with Turkey being probably the safest of the Middle Eastern or European Eastern countries, I found that interesting.
But didn't things change after the rioting went on in Istanbul, I mean, in terms of safety concerns, and also the border of Syria?
Yeah, the border of Syria is a problem because there's a lot of refugees coming across, but that's not Turkey's, you know, fault. That's another country.
I mean, as far as the safety of being in Turkey.
But I don't think of Turkey as an unsafe country in any way.
I don't think most people do. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call, Dave, and we'll just go to another caller, and that's Michelle, who's joining us from Livermore. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I was an intelligence terrorism analyst in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s. Before the really widespread use of the internet, and when incidents would occur that we'd have to look into in out-of-the-way places, I covered Africa. So we relied very heavily on the Lonely Planet guides, just for, you know, places a lot of us had never been, but Lonely Planet folks had been, and so they had nice little maps, and we could find things. Yeah, it was very helpful.
So how does that make Tony Wheeler feel, that you're helping U.S. intelligence?
Well, what can I say? There was one thing that I said, you know, that there's more intelligence on the Lonely Planet Iran guide on Iran than anything that comes out of Washington, D.C. once.
Very helpful.
Yeah, well, thank you for the call. And here's a Facebook listener, a listener writes on Facebook, I'm traveling to Kenya in 2 weeks to Samburu. Do you have any advice on health and safety?
Well, you know, Kenya is a place that has its real ups and downs. I mean, there definitely has been some extraordinarily unsafe things in Kenya in recent years. And equally, it's been one of the most popular destinations in Africa because in some ways it's safer than some other places.
Concern about Ebola now, though.
No, that's on the West Coast.
No, I mean just in Africa in general.
Well, in Africa in general. But then, you know, it's really a West Coast thing more than the East side. And Kenya, you know, I've been there and I'd go there again.
Would you go to El Salvador, Laura wants to know, writing on Facebook.
Well, you know, I was talking to someone last night who was saying, you really should go to El Salvador. It's such an interesting country. I'm going to try and promote it some more. El Salvador's one of those worrying places. Yeah, no question.
It's like the old frontier on the streets you hear. I mean, that caller who talked about, you know, the shooting going on in the market and everything.
Yeah.
Honduras, El Salvador, a lot of that.
Yeah, well, a lot of it, but then, you know,
lot of that in Oakland, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, if you read the papers in Europe, you'd think, you know, you have to step off the plane with a... You know, wearing armor plate.
Yeah, you read about gang stuff here, for example, or you read about random shootings and, you know, that sort of thing.
But we don't drive home from work worrying about it, do we?
Well, tourists who come here do, though.
Yeah. And
let me get another caller on. Kathy, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm planning to go to Guatemala in November with my family, and I wonder what you think about Guatemala as a destination and if there's anything in particular to avoid or to see.
Well, the two reasons, I think, that people very often go to Guatemala, one is for learning Spanish. You know, it's one of the major centers in Central America for Spanish classes and Spanish courses, and a lot of young people go down there to improve their Spanish. That's a big attraction. And also, of course, it's got some of the great ruins of Central America. It's up there with the Mayan regions of Mexico.
And great pottery and great...
Oh, great pottery, artwork.
Objects.
Very colorful. That's what I always think of it. And I haven't been to Guatemala for more than 10 years. But my daughter's been there in the last year or two. So
it's safer now, though. I mean, during the Ocho Rios era, and that was pretty...
Yeah, there's been things going wrong, but not, you know... It's up like almost like Costa Rica as being a safer destination in the region.
But you were talking about sides of Africa that are safe from Ebola. There are sides of Costa Rica that are less safe than others, too.
Yeah, well, true.
And we'll actually, Stav asks, is Tony in the area for Burning Man? Is there any place he just won't go?
Do you know, I haven't been to Burning Man. That's another of those. Up there with the Yemen. the Yemen and Burning Man.
A whole laundry list from this hour with us.
Yeah.
Places to go. But is there any place that you would not go or you would stay away from?
There's places. I mean, I've been to Syria and I've had a wonderful time in Syria. It was one of my just the best trips I've done. And yet right now I wouldn't
no,
be racing
would
to go to Syria.
No,
let it sort out first.
Well, we'll go to San Rafael and we'll welcome Nick onto the air. Nick, you're on.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say that if you want to go out and look for trouble, you can find it anywhere.
Yeah.
With safety and insecurity. And I've been to Guatemala in the 90s and Turkey in the 70s and the East where the Kurds were fighting and in Algeria. And I've found places in the Bay Area or other places in the U.S. to be sort of more frightening for me than some of those places. And a caller called earlier about Kuala Lumpur. No issues there whatsoever. So use common sense. If you have the travel bug, go out there and see the world. Take caution wherever you go and give everybody a fair chance before you paint them a certain color.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
good wise words, Nick. Thank you for that. And actually, I was thinking about Congo again, where most people would perhaps not hesitate to stay away from there. But you paint a picture, particularly of the bonobos, that makes it well worth going.
Yes, the bonobos, chimpanzees with sex on their mind. Somebody, I met a researcher who was there, got her PhD studying bonobos, and she said, if you want to read more about what I've done with, you know, what I've researched with bonobos, just Google my name and the word sex, and it'll all pop up. And she was 100% correct.
Yes, they are rather randy creatures, but also Pacific creatures, or so
yes,
it would seem.
Yes, yes. Make love, not war. That's their belief.
And here's Larry. Larry, join us.
I was in Congo a couple of years ago and going back in about 2 weeks, and I had the funniest experience there and the saddest. The funniest is at 4 in the morning on a Sunday, on a Congo day, totally dark out, and I heard this screaming, shouting, and running of large numbers of feet outside my room. Thought there was some armed insurrection or something. It went on for about 2 hours. When the sun came up, my host, I was staying with a Congolese, came to my room and said, I said to him, what was that? He says, oh, it's Sunday morning. Everyone does the jogging. They do it in groups. And here I was, you know, terrified that something horrible was going on.
Yeah, but you had a bad experience, and we got seconds left. Can you give it to us real quick?
Bad experience? My host, niece, and nephew were murdered by soldiers of the Democratic Republic of Congo during that visit.
Well, there you go.
Sorry. So sorry for that. Sad note to end on. But you can actually see and meet Tony Wheeler this evening at 7 p.m. We'll be at the Hoover Theater in San Jose with the Commonwealth Club. Always good to have you on Forum.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And the new book, again, is called Dark Lands. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and we get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.